we concluded chapter one of our series, From Here to Eternity, we spoke of the development and the founding of the United Nations. The United Nations and UNESCO were created in the wake of the worst war carnage the world had ever witnessed. Conditioned by a constant stream of propaganda produced by the CFR in America and by the Royal Institute of International Affairs in Europe, the move toward global governance was accepted and allowed to go forward. Julian Huxley realized, however, that to be successful over the long haul, a worldwide constituency would have to be developed. In 1948, Huxley and his longtime friend and colleague Max Nicholson, both of whom were involved with the Royal Institute of International Affairs, created the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, better known as the IUCN. The IUCN drew heavily from the 50-year-old British Fauna and Flora Preservation Society for its leadership, funding, and members. Sir Peter Scott, chairman of the FFPS, drafted the IUCN Charter and headed one of its important commissions. This important non-governmental organization, the NGO, was instrumental in the formation of the World Wildlife Fund in 1961 and the World Resource Institute in 1982. These three NGOs are to the United Nations system what the CFR was to Franklin Delano Roosevelt, or what Edward Mandel House was to Woodrow Wilson. These three NGOs have become the driving force behind the rise of global governance. Good day, once again, Mr. and Mrs. America, and to all the freedom-loving Christians and patriots all across this great republic and around the world, we bid you to Chapter 2 of From Here to Eternity, as heard here on Perspectives on America. I am your host, Jeffrey Bennett, not only for the program, but for this series. Today we're going to be discussing the Cold War and the beginning of the environmental movement. Now, the Cold War and this dream of world dominance is not, nor has it ever been, the pursuit by an exclusive cadre of conspirators. The dream has been held by many different factions, often simultaneously, always in competition with one another. By 1950, at least three major forces, all competing for world dominance, were clearly identified. Each of the three major forces worked overtly and covertly to achieve their objectives. The Soviet Union had nearly defined its Marx-Lenin-Stalin version of communism. Its systematic program of expansionism, including an active organization in the United States, fully intended to bring all the world under its very control. And so confident were the Soviets of their eventual success that on his 1959 tour of the United States, Nikita Khrushchev pounded his shoe on a podium before the television cameras and declared to America, "We will bury you!" America would have no part of a world under communist rule. Senator Joseph McCarthy led a crusade against communism, or communism and communists in America, as we well know, specifically those who've listened to this program for any length of time. McCarthy's campaign tarnished many non-communists, but was successful in rooting out Alger Hiss, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, and Morton Sobel, all convicted of espionage-related crimes. And because of the statute of limitations, Hiss could not be tried for espionage, but in fact was convicted of perjury for lying about his espionage activities. More importantly, the televised McCarthy hearings awakened America to the communist threat, and when U.S. troops entered Korea to fight the communists, support the Communist Party, for the Communist Party, U.S. of America, diminished steadily from a high of more than 100,000 members to its current low of maybe between 1,000 and 2,000 known members. American leaders did not pound their shoes nor proclaim a program of world dominance. American foreign and economic policy, however, left no doubt that at the very least, America intended to prevent the Soviets from achieving said world dominance, at least their version of it. The third force competing for world dominance was not the United Nations, but the people whose dreams of a world government were frustrated by what the United Nations turned out to be. The annihilation of the League of Nations by the U.S. Senate left the advocates of world government with a large dose of reality. They realized that the United Nations could exist only by the grace of the United States and the Soviets, and that the United Nations itself could have no authority or power over the major powers. But it was a real start toward global governance, which provided an official, if impotent, mechanism for the incremental implementation of their global aspirations. During the 1950s and 1960s, the United Nations was little more than a debating society that occasionally attempted to referee disputes among the major world powers. Public attention was riveted on domestic issues and the deepening Cold War. Russia's Sputnik launch was a catalyst for the launch of the U.S. space program. Fidel Castro's embrace of communism in Cuba stiffened America's policy of containment, first articulated in the CFR journal, Foreign Affairs. The 1954 Supreme Court desegregation decision pushed McCarthy, communism, and the United Nations completely off the domestic radar screen. Rosa Parks' refusal to give up her seat on a Birmingham bus to a white man was the fuse that ignited an explosion of racial riots. Federal troops confronted Alabama National Guardsmen over Governor Orville Faubus' refusal to let 9 black children enter the Little Rock Central High School. Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his now infamous I Have a Dream speech, which we all well know by now was plagiarized from a white professor from Columbia University, as had been given by him in 1952. But nonetheless, King gave that speech to 250,000 people on the Mall in Washington, D.C., and tanks rolled on the streets of Chicago and Detroit. Domestic events also obscured American awareness of the creation of the World Wildlife Fund. The same Julian Huxley who founded UNESCO and the IUCN, along with his friend Max Nicholson, as we'd previously mentioned, formed the organization primarily as a way to fund the work of the IUCN. Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, served as president. An auxiliary organization called the 1001 Club charged an initiation fee of $10,000, which went into a trust fund to provide ongoing revenues to the WWF. WWF and the IUCN share an office building to this day in Gland, Switzerland. Now, by 1987, by the way, the name was changed to something that may be more familiar for you today. It was changed to the Worldwide Fund for Nature, but the acronym remained the same. Behind the scenes, America developed and launched the Nautilus, the first of a new generation of atomic-powered submarines. Both Russia and America tested nuclear devices with ever-increasing payloads. Bomb shelters were the mainstay of civil defense. You remember those days? And school children were taught to duck and cover. The official defense policy was MAD, M-A-D, Mutually Assured Destruction. But much, much further behind the scenes, plans were being developed to defuse the MAD policy. You see, the UN had no authority nor power in its own right to do anything about the spiraling arms race between the world's two superpowers. And so it became the stage on which the advocates of global governance performed their strategic play, using the U.S. and the Soviet Union in the starring roles. In 1961, newly elected President John F. Kennedy presented a disarmament plan called Freedom from War, United States Program for General and Complete Disarmament in a Peaceful World. It was also known as the Department of State publication 7277. The plan called for 3 phases, which would ultimately result in the gradual transfer of U.S. military power to the United Nations. The plan called for all nations to follow the U.S.-led and disarm themselves to a point where, quote, no state would have the military power to challenge the progressively strengthened U.N. peace force, end of quote. A new and improved version of the same idea was presented in May of 1962, and it was called the Blueprint for the Peace Race outline of basic provisions of a treaty on general and complete disarmament in a peaceful world. It was released by the U.S. Arms Control and Disarmament Agency. It's known as Publication 4, General Series 3, dated May 3, 1962, and it was headed by a man named John McCloy. Now, it's neither fair nor accurate to say that these documents were the product of the CFR. It is, however, accurate and instructive to realize that these documents were developed by men who were members of the CFR. McCloy and Robert Lovett were described as distinguished individuals in an article by Kennedy, which appeared in Foreign Affairs in 1957. Lovett was offered his choice of cabinet positions in the Kennedy administration, however declined, choosing instead to make recommendations, all of which were accepted by Kennedy. Lovett recommended Dean Rusk as Secretary of State. Rusk, of course, had been a member of the CFR since 1952 and had published an article in Foreign Affairs in 1960 on how the new president should conduct foreign policy. The New York Times then reported that of the first 82 names submitted to Kennedy for State Department positions, 63 were members of the CFR. And like FDR and every president since, JFK filled his State Department and surrounded himself with individuals who were, perhaps coincidentally, members of the CFR. Lovett, John McCloy, Dean Rusk, McGeorge Bundy, Adlai Stevenson, who was JFK's ambassador to the UN, all members of the CFR, all of whom guided Kennedy through the disastrous Bay of Pigs operation and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Now, that members of the CFR have exercised extraordinary influence on foreign policy, my friends, it cannot be denied. Whether that influence is the result of organizational strategies or the result of individuals who simply happen to be members of the same organization is an endlessly debated question. Richard Harwood of the Washington Post observed once that members of the CFR, quote, are the closest thing we have to a ruling establishment in the United States. The president is a member, so is his Secretary of State, the Deputy Secretary of State, all five of the undersecretaries, several of the assistant secretaries, and the department's legal advisor. The president's national security advisor and his deputies are members. The director of the Central Intelligence, like all previous directors, and the chairman of the Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board are members. The Secretary of Defense, three undersecretaries, and at least four assistant secretaries are members. The secretaries of the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Interior, Health, Human Services, Chief White House Public Relations Man, along with the Speaker of the House, are all members of the CFR. This is not a retinue of people who look like America, as the president once put it, but they very definitely look like the people who, for more than half a century, have managed our international affairs and our military-industrial complex. End of a very long quote. We're going to go for a quick interlude here. Who are you? I am America. Let's go for a little bit of Steve Voss here. And we'll return from here to eternity.
I'm a trucker, I'm a teacher, I'm a clerk in a grocery store. I work the graveyard shift in a factory, sweeping floors. I'm a soldier, I'm a farmer, I'm a carpenter by trade. I'm out of work, hear me when I say, I am America, proud as can be. I own this country too, from sea to shining sea. My father settled here just to be free. Yeah.
I'm a father, I'm a mother, I'm a baby just been born. I'm in my golden years, knocking on heaven's door. I'm a red man, I'm a white man, I am brown man, yellow man, black. I'm every man, woman, child, and I want my country back. I am America.
Article 11 of the UN Charter gives the General Assembly authority to consider and recommend principles of governing disarmament and the regulation of armaments, but virtually no authority to enforce disarmament. Kennedy's proposal, however, was a bold first step toward giving the UN the power which early necessary compromises had stripped from the original vision of a world government. And my friends, the Kennedy plan has never been revoked. Though modified and delayed by political necessity, the essential principle of relinquishing arms as well as control of the production and distribution of arms to the UN has guided the disarmament policy of every American president since JFK. Prior to the Kennedy disarmament plan, the UN sponsored a truce supervision operation in 1948 and a military observer group in India and Pakistan in 1949. And since the Kennedy disarmament plan, the number of UN peacekeeping operations has steadily increased to the point where we are involved in nearly 120 of them around this world today. And still further behind the scenes, the fledgling United Nations was beginning to take shape. The UNICEF, or United Nations International Emergency Children's Fund, was created in 1946 to provide emergency relief to the child victims of World War II. It was reauthorized in 1950 to shift its emphasis to programs of long-term benefit to children in underdeveloped countries. But you see, it became a permanent UN entity in 1953. UNESCO's purpose was to educate the world. UNICEF was created to provide the mechanism through which that education could be delivered to children. UN Article 55 provides for the UN to promote higher standards of living, full employment, conditions of economic and social progress and development, end quote. But to fulfill this charge, the UN Expanded Program of Technical Assistance, or UNEPTA, was created in 1949 and expanded with a special fund in 1957. By 1959, the program had been transformed into the United Nations Development Program, or UNDP, now headed, or some time ago was headed by James Gustav Speth, former president of the World Resources Institute, which spends more than $1 trillion annually, mostly in developing countries. Who, by the way, do you think funds the majority of that? Well, the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestine Refugees in the Near East, or UNRWA, was created in 1949. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees was created in 1951. The UN Food and Agriculture Organization brought together existing international food programs in 1946 and began its World Food Program in 1963. The UN's International Atomic Energy Agency was created in 1953. The International Civil Aviation Organization in 1947. International Labor Organization, created in 1919 as an instrument of the failed League of Nations, was reconstituted and folded into the United Nations in 1948. The International Maritime Organization was authorized in 1947. Founded in 1863, the Universal Postal Union became an entity of the UN in 1948. The World Health Organization was created in 1948. The International Telecommunications Union, which had existed since 1865, was folded into the United Nations system in 1949. The United Nations Industrial Development Organization was created in 1966. The World Intellectual Property Organization was established in 1967. And these are only a few of the 130-plus UN agencies and organizations which proliferated during and since the Cold War. And while the UN organization was expanding exponentially, out of the media spotlight, which was focused on race riots and the arms race, UNESCO plodded forward with its mission to educate the world. Robert Mueller, longtime Secretary General of the UN's Economic and Social Council, under which the UNESCO operates, delivered a speech at the University in Denver in 1995. His musings and recollections provided valuable insights into the kind of education UNESCO was preparing for the world. And from Mueller's own comments on that fateful day, he stated, "I had written an essay which was circulated by UNESCO and which earned me the title of Father of Global Education. I was educated badly in France," he says. "I've come to the conclusion that the only correct education that I have received in my life was from the United Nations. We should replace the word politics by planetics. We need planetary management, planetary caretakers. We need global sciences. We need a science of a global psychology, a global sociology, a global anthropology." And then he concludes, "I made my proposal for a world core curriculum." Well, the first goal of Mueller's world core curriculum is assisting the child in becoming an integrated individual who can deal with personal experience while seeing himself as a part of the greater whole. In other words, promote growth of the group idea so that group good, group understanding, group interrelations, group goodwill replace all limited self-centered objectives, leading to group consciousness. The World Core Curriculum Manual, my friends, states thusly: "The underlying philosophy upon which the Robert Mueller School is based will be found in the teachings set forth in the books of Alice A. Bailey by the Tibetan teacher Jual Kul, published by Lucas Publishing Company in New York, and the teachings of M. Moria as given in the Agni Yoga Series books." Well, Alice Bailey established the Lucifer Publishing Company, which was renamed Lucis, L-U-C-I-S, Lucis Press in 1924, expressly to publish and distribute her own writings and those of Jual Kul, which consisted of some 20 books written by Bailey as the channeling agent for the disembodied Tibetan she called Jual Kul. And until some years ago, the Lucis Trust, parent organization of the Lucis Press, was headquartered at the United Nations Plaza in New York. Bailey assumed the leadership of the Theosophical Society upon the death of Helena Petrovna Blavatsky. The society's 6,000 members included such luminaries, people as Robert McNamara, Donald Reagan, Henry Kissinger, David Rockefeller, Paul Volcker, George Shultz, and the names that also appear on the membership roster of the CFR. Hindsight, my friends, reveals that while the United States was performing on the United Nations stage as if it were a three-ring circus and we were monkeys jumping through their hoops, We were sparring with the Soviet Union, keeping score with nuclear warheads, the forces which heavily influenced the official policies of both the United States and the United Nations were actually outside both governments, non-government organization, or the so-called NGOs. Three distinct NGO influences were clear by the end of the 1960s. The CFR and its assortment of affiliated spin-off organizations, the mystic, occult, or so-called New Age spiritual movement, and the growing number of organizations affiliated with the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. In 1968, the IUCN, led a lobbying effort with the United Nations Economic and Social Council, headed by Robert Mueller. The purpose was to adopt Resolution 1296, which grants consultative status to certain NGOs. This resolution paved the highway for global governance. The Lucis Trust was one of the first NGOs to be granted consultative status with the UN. Adolf Hitler once made this statement. The people gaze fascinated at one or two familiar superficialities such as possessions, income, rank, and other outworn conceptions, and as long as these are kept intact, they are quite satisfied. But in the meantime, they have entered the new relation. The powerful social force has caught up with them. I'll be back in a few moments as we begin to discuss the environmental movement, which began to grow in the 1970s. Back in 1968, I was stationed in Vietnam, and I heard a piece of music which has been referred to as an orchestral jazz suite. It was composed, orchestrated, and conducted by Gary McFarland. The piece of music you listen to now is the opening piece from that album. It's called On This Site Shall Be Erected. The name of the album was America the Beautiful, an account of its disappearance. I will return in a few moments. In the 1970s, we began to witness the growth of the environmental movement. Not a single vote was cast against the Wilderness Act of 1964 when it finally reached the Senate. Congress thought it was setting aside 9 million acres of wilderness so posterity could see a sample of what their forefathers had to conquer in order to create America. The new law was the crowning achievement of the Wilderness Society, to which its director, Howard Zanischer, had devoted 5 years of constant lobbying. Though unnoticed at the time, the new law signaled an end to the traditional conservation movement at the beginning of a new environmental preservation movement. The conservation movement might be characterized by the idea that private landowners should voluntarily conserve natural resources. The environmental preservation movement is characterized by the notion that the government should enforce conservation measures through extensive regulations. Well, by this distinction, the Wilderness Society brought the environmental movement to Congress. Robert Marshall, Benton McKay, and Aldo Leopold, all avowed socialists, organized the society in the early 1930s and proclaimed their socialist ideas loudly. Marshall's 1933 book entitled The People's Forest states thusly,
"Public ownership is the only basis on which we can hope to protect the incalculable values of the forest for wood resources, for soil and water conservation, and for recreation. Regardless of whether it might be desirable, it is impossible under our existing form of government to confiscate the private forests into public ownership. We cannot afford to delay their nationalization until the form of government changes."
End of quote. Well, this significant event failed to register a blip on the radar screen of public awareness. Instead, public attention focused on racial strife, the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago, and the Vietnam War, which had torn apart the convention, the party, and the nation. The first Earth Day in 1970, which perhaps coincidentally was celebrated on Lenin's birthday and has been ever since, was viewed as little more than a festival for flower children. The anti-war fervor again brought a quarter of a million protesters to the mall, and Watergate brought down the Nixon presidency. The Clean Water Act of 1972 and the Endangered Species Act of 73 served as beacons to attract the energies and idealism of a generation of young people who had successfully forced the world's most powerful government to abandon a war they sought to be unjust. The 1970s witnessed an unprecedented explosion in the number of environmental organizations and on the number of people who joined and, in fact, supported those organizations. Among the more important but lesser-known organizations formed during this period were the Club of Rome in 1968, the Trilateral Commission in 1973. The COR, or Club of Rome, is a small group of international industrialists, educators, economists, national and international civil servants. Among them, of course, were various Rockefellers and approximately 25 CFR members. Maurice Strong was one of the international civil servants. Their first book, entitled The Limits to Growth, published in 1972, unabashedly described the world as they believe it should be. "We believe, in fact, that the need will quickly become evident for social innovation to match technical change, for radical reform of the institutions and political processes at all levels, including the highest, that of world polity. And since intellectual enlightenment is without effect if it is not also political, the Club of Rome also will encourage the creation of a world forum where statesmen, policymakers, and scientists can discuss the dangers and hopes for the future global system without the constraints of formal intergovernmental negotiation." End quote. Well, the world reform was authorized in 1972 by UN Resolution 2997 as the UN Conference on the Human Environment. Maurice Strong was designated Secretary General of the conference, which, among other things, recommended the creation of the United Nations Environment Program, which came into being January 1 of 1973, with Maurice Strong as its first executive director. The conference, held in Stockholm, produced 26 principles and 109 specific recommendations, which parroted much of the language in the COR publications. The difference was, of course, that the conference report carried the weight of the United Nations and has had profound policy implications for the entire world. Now, another COR publication, entitled Mankind at the Turning Point, provides further insight into the thinking that underlies global governance. It states thusly, "The solution of these crises can be developed only in a global context with full an explicit recognition of the emerging world system and on a long-term basis. This would necessitate, among other changes, a new world economic order and a global resources allocation system. A world consciousness must be developed through which every individual realizes his role as a member of the world community. It must become part of the consciousness of every individual that the basic unit of human cooperation and hence survival is moving from the national to the global level. End quote. A companion work by the same authors, Mihailo Misarovic and Edward Pestel, entitled Regionalized, an Adaptive Model of the Global World System, introduced and described a system of regionalization which divided the globe into 10 regions, each with its own hierarchical system of subregions. The Trilateralists published a book entitled Beyond Interdependence, The Meshing of the World's Economy and the Earth's Ecology by Jim McNeil. David Rockefeller wrote the foreword. Maurice Strong wrote the introduction, and Strong said this: "This interlocking is the new reality of the century, with profound implications for the shape of our institutions of governance, national and international. By the year 2012, these changes must be fully integrated into our economic and political life." Well, my friends, in retrospect, it is clear that the early work of the United Nations was an effort to achieve global consensus on the philosophy upon which its programmatic work would be built. It's also clear that despite the disproportionate share of the cost borne by capitalist nations, the prevailing philosophy at the United Nations is essentially socialist. The fundamental idea upon which America was founded, that men are born totally free and choose to give up specific freedoms to a limited government, is not the prevailing philosophy at the UN, nor at the CFR, the COR, the TC, or the IUCN. Instead, the prevailing philosophy held by these organizations and institutions is that government is sovereign and may dispense or withhold freedoms and privileges or impose restrictions and penalties in order to manage its citizens to achieve peace and prosperity for all. In his book, Freedom at the Altar, noted author William Griggs says it this way: "Under the American concept of rights, the individual possesses God-given rights which the state must protect. However, the United Nations embraces a collectivist worldview in which rights are highly conditional concessions made by an all-powerful government." Another description of the difference between the two ideas is offered by Philip Barne in his book entitled The Coming Century of Communism. He states, "In the Western constitutional concept, limited government is established to protect the fundamental natural human rights of the free individuals in a free society. In a radical socialist concept of the state, the citizen has a duty to the state to help the state promote the socialization or communization of the man." These fundamentally different, conflicting ideas, my friends, have been described differently by different people at different times. In 1842, Marx and Engels preached their gospel through an organization known as the Federation of the Just. In 1845, it was the International Democratic Association of Brussels that promoted their ideas. By 1903, the organization that championed Marxism was the Russian Social Democratic Workers' Party, before Lenin transformed it into the Communist Party. The names used to describe the prevailing philosophy at the UN are, albeit confusing to Americans, regardless of the name attached, the underlying philosophy has several common characteristics that readily identify it as different from the philosophy upon which America was founded. Chief among those characteristics is the abhorrence of private property. As Philip Bourne had pointed out, in the Communist Manifesto, Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels identified communism with democracy. "The communist revolution is the most radical rupture with traditional property relations to win the battle of democracy." Well, Marx and Engels also pointed out, quote, the abolition of existing property relations is not at all a distinctive feature of communism. The distinctive feature of communism is the abolition of private property, end quote. Another telltale characteristic of socialist communist philosophy is the assumption of omnipotent government. Born addressed the semantics problem as well as the omnipotent government issue in this fashion. He stated, the war of words and worldviews of democracy continues, but with greater confusion of priorities. President Reagan professed that freedom and democracy are the best guarantors for peace. Gorbachev confessed that peace and maximum democracy are the guarantors of freedom. Our aim, he said, is to grant maximum freedom to people, to the individual, to society. Well, in the Gorbachev statement, it was assumed that freedom is the government's to give. The U.S. Constitution clearly views freedom to be the natural condition of man and assigns the protection of freedom as government's first responsibility. International equality, equity, social justice, security of the people, democratic society, all are terms used in U.N. documents that have a completely different meaning in a socialist context from the meaning understood in America. These differences, my friends, become exceedingly important in the context of official UN documents. Consider the language. In the UN's Covenant on Human Rights, a document that bears approximately the same relation to the UN Charter that the Bill of Rights bears to the US Constitution. Article 13 of the UN Charter states, freedom to manifest one's religion or beliefs may be subject only to such limitations as are prescribed by law. Now, by contrast, our Bill of Rights states, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, end quote. Article 14 of the UN Covenant states, the right to seek, receive and impart information and ideas carries with it special duties and responsibilities and may therefore be subject to certain penalties, liabilities, and restrictions, but these shall be only such as are provided by law. Our Bill of Rights says, Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. Period. And so, my friends, you see the philosophy of omnipotent government permeates virtually all of the documents that have flowed from the United Nations since its inception. Consider the preamble to the report of the First World Conference on Human Settlements, or Habitat I, which was held in 1976 under the auspices of Maurice Strong's newly formed United Nations Environmental Program, wherein it states, private land ownership is a principal instrument of accumulating wealth and therefore contributes to social injustice. Public control of land use is therefore indispensable. Well, their recommendation went on to state that public ownership of land is justified in favor of the common good rather than to protect the interest of the already privileged. Morris Udall, the late Morris Udall from Arizona, and others tried unsuccessfully to implement the Federal Land Use Planning Act in the early 1970s, influenced by those seeking to impose global governance. In the early 1970s, the UN created a commission to study the Organization of Peace. As if singing in the same choir, the U.S. created a commission to study the Organization of Peace. On May Day, 1974, a proposal was submitted to the United Nations General Assembly calling for a new international economic order. It was adopted as a Charter of Economic Rights and Duties of States on December 12, 1974. It called then for the redistribution of wealth and political power and the promotion of international justice based on the duties of developed countries and the rights of developing countries. Throughout the 1970s, college students and others joined environmental organizations in droves, my friends. They protested, they carried placards, they picked up litter, they preached recycling and organic gardening, mostly unaware that their leaders were attending conferences and promoting agendas
based on the same philosophy that America had opposed in Vietnam, in Cuba, in the Soviet Union, and so carefully crafted documents, magnified by a cooperative media, elevated the environment to a most noble cause. The object of near worship for an army of energetic activists, the environment as an international issue, was ripe for the picking by the advocates of global governance. If I'm elected. Movement number 4 in Gary McFarland's America the Beautiful. It's a piece entitled If I'm Elected. Throughout the majority of this second chapter of From Here to Eternity, which is the program you're listening to. This is a program that will be presented to you in 4 parts. And you're listening to Chapter 2 today. From Here to Eternity. In effect, we talk about the emergence of global governance. The majority of Chapter 2 talks about the beginnings of the environmental movement. In a few minutes, we're going to discuss more of it. Let me take a few minutes now. As many of you know, we tend to not be particularly commercial in our programming. This is a program that for many of you may be tedious because it is so detailed in its facts. There was a series we did some years ago called Rich Man, Poor Man, Beggar Man, Thief. We talked about the founding of the Rothschild family, albeit the Bauer family, who stole the name and set up shop in a banking or an old bakery. But there were several chapters in that 8-hour series where we at length discussed CFR members, members of the Trilaterals, members of the many of these other organizations, the Club of Rome, etc., etc. For a number of reasons, we have not made Rich Man, Poor Man available for quite some time. It is currently noted as back-ordered on our catalog at the Federal Observer. And there's good reason for this. There is some editing that I need to do. I'm not going to do any new recording. We're not going to bring it up to date or modernize it per se, because the programs that we have tried to provide you in our programs for the past 8.5 years, and it could be longer by the time you're listening to this recording, is a window on the world. It is a window on history per se. And this series you're listening to has become interesting to me because it update so much of what we made available in Rich Man, Poor Man, brings it somewhat more up to date. Certainly we have a much heavier, we have a very intensely heavy segment on the environmental movement, which many of you may not care about. And that is disheartening to me, because you need to understand who has been behind the environmental movement, what their goals are, what their agenda is. It's no different than the kind of people who are behind the anti-gun movement. They may be the same players, they may be different players, but each one of them serves their purpose. In the effect of the environmental movement, it has to do with the destruction of private property and the ability for them to take it away from us. And we read of many, many battles that are going on around the country, whether it be some
suspected endangered ant or polliwog that may happen to choose to swim across that farmer's plot of land because it was known that 200 years ago they had been there. This may sound far-fetched to many of you. The entire problematic scenario we've had in this nation over the last couple of years with these horrendous forest fires in Colorado, in New Mexico, in Arizona, more recently in California, they are all subject, in my personal opinion, albeit a somewhat uneducated opinion, all of this plays directly into the hands of the so-called tree huggers. And for people who love trees as much as they're doing, they sure don't love them for the right reasons. Because in my personal estimation, they're loving them for the purposes of perpetual paychecks. Because if they cared, it's no different than getting your hair cut. You have your hair cut and thinned out to promote healthier growth of your hair. You do the same thing with the forest, my friends. I think there's a lot of tremendous information in here that should be shared with many, many, many people. It really, truly begins to show this entire UN biosphere, hemisphere, land grab in this country. The whole purpose is why the Clinton administration, and followed up by the Bush administration, seems to be so willing to just flat turn our lands over to the control of the United Nations. Now, if the United Nations is not about global governance, my friends, I just don't know what is. Once again, the cost of the four-hour compact disc program, $29.95. I hope you'll support this program by ordering copies of this series. I feel it is important work, not because I'm doing it, but because the information is so important. I feel it needs to be shared with people who think you're maybe a little off your rocker as your stand on environmental issues, although we certainly go far beyond environmental and will be doing so in the coming several hours. I think it's a great educational tool for children, for grandchildren. I recently had quite a discussion with my son who has finally realized what a rotten education he received in the public school system. So at the age of 20, my son is finally beginning to listen to his father. And he begins to realize that what I do on the air each and every day, 5 days a week, and have done for well over 8 years now, doesn't have a damn thing to do with money. It has to do with truth. It has to do with education. It has to do with history, that which we all need to learn and relearn and be able to share with our family and loved ones. In our next installment, Chapter 3 of our series, From Here to Eternity, we're going to pick up where we left off with further discussion of the environmental movement. And whereas we chiefly discussed the 1970s, today we're going to move into the 1980s and 90s and beyond. Until the good Lord sees fit to bring us together again, my friends, without apology, I am Jeffrey Bennett.
I've been waiting for something to happen for a week or a month or a year. With the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before. Where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance. There are people under fire. There are children at the cannons. And there is blood.
a shadow on the faces of the men who fed the flame.
Hey there, are you going to wait till the cows come home to get your new ease-off drop-in lift?
What in the world is an ease-off drop-in lift?
Our ease-off is a new tool to increase production for your meat processing company that will get that whole hog or half a beef on or off your rail with our remote control.
That sounds great, but can I afford it?
Sure, and the ease-off installs fast. The effortless operation will reduce fatigue, speed up your line, and increase profits.
Okay, I'm convinced. Where can I get my ease-off?
Go to easeoff.com. That's EAZEOFF.com. And hurry, because we're offering free shipping for a limited time. EaseOff.com. We make pigs fly. Cows, too.
EaseOff LLC, 417-932-6419.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
My name is John. I'm the founder of Blackout Coffee, and I started Blackout because I really love coffee. I've always loved coffee, and after traveling so much to Europe, South America, and trying so many different coffees that were so good, and every time I came back to the U.S., I was so disappointed with the coffee, so I figured that I had to do something about it. The biggest difference is on the beans and the roasting process, how we roast it, and how fresh it is. The fresher the roast, the better the quality. Here I have like all of the coffee. It's roasted within 1 to 2 days prior to being shipped. So it literally gets to consumers' house within 3 to 5 days after being roasted. If you like coffee, you have to try ours. It's fresh roasted. It's one of the best beans that we can get, and you will definitely see the difference.
Visit blackoutcoffee.com and use the coupon code REPUB10. That's REPUB10.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.